All right, I think let's begin. We're a minute past, and I think we've got a pretty full discussion today. We'll still have more people coming in, but we'll go. But anyway, thank you everyone for joining our biweekly KISSA Zoom roundtable. Appreciate your time this afternoon. Hopefully, we'll have a robust discussion. Format for today's call is a panel discussion. We've got a great panel of four. I ask it that you all keep your mics muted unless you are speaking. We do have a chat function at the bottom. I think everyone's probably quite familiar with that at this point. So please feel free to use that at any point, and we'll try and get to as many questions as possible. Please also remember that this COVID situation that we're in is extremely fluid and things are changing almost daily. I just bring that up because what we discussed today may be entirely different tomorrow or in a week from now, and that's certainly consistent with many of the conversations I've been having. So keep that in mind. And also, as you look at your cross-country operation, bear in mind that we have a lot of opportunity to do things differently now, and this is a great time to think about your operations, think about some of what you're offering, and look at new ways perhaps to do it that may be better than what you're currently doing. So keep that in mind. All right. With that said, allow me to introduce our panelists for today. We have Christy Hicks, Executive Director for the Crested Butte Nordic in Crested Butte. Justin Beckwith, the Competitions Program Director from the New England Nordic Ski Association. Adam St. Pierre, XC Sport Coordinator from U.S. Ski and Snowboard, and Richard Hodges, Nordic Director from White Pine. Christy, I'm going to start with you today. I'm looking for you. I know you're there somewhere. Crested Butte recently ran a trail and bike endurance race, and I know in talking to you, you spent a lot of time kind of looking at that and getting clearance to run it. Can you share a little bit about the planning that went into that and then the format changes that enabled your authorities to greenlight your event?
Sure. Yeah, we call it the Summer Grand Traverse. It's a trail version of our Winter Grand Traverse race that is traditionally a point-to-point race between Crested Butte and Aspen. And we do it, it's over 2 days in the summer. The Saturday is a run that traditionally goes from Crested Butte to Aspen. And then on Sunday, we do a mountain bike that goes from Aspen back to Crested Butte. This year, our county was having good success with controlling COVID numbers, and regulations were loosening. And Pitkin County, where Aspen is, was not going at the same pace. And so by mid-July, we had to make a call to change the race from a point-to-point to a loop race, all within one county. So, and that was just the first of a million changes that we had to implement. There was truly no, we had to reinvent every single part of the race after that. There was nothing that was left the same, not the start, the finish, or the aid stations. So we had a lot of success working with our county to modify the start line, the bib pickup process, and the finish line and the aid stations along the way. And those were the main points. And then after seeing the race in action, and we just got all of our racer survey data back the last couple days as well, is that start was really the most critical part. It's pretty easy to, you know, keep people distanced at the aid stations and the finish line, but controlling the start was the biggest challenge. And so we had the races up to 350 people. And so we had, but the maximum group size in Colorado right now is 250 for an outdoor event. So we had to create two different start zones to essentially create two different events of where people would be gathered in large outdoor spaces. And then we staggered the starts. We alternated each of those start zones every minute over the course of half an hour or so, so that each start wave was 2 minutes apart in each zone, but we'd alternate. So there was actually a start going every minute. And then everyone was chipped so that their time would just start when they passed a a banner further down the course. And it sounded crazy when we were first talking about it, but in execution, it worked really well, and it was very kind of a calm, very well spaced start. We also had to make that work, we had to come up with a way to seed racers. So we had them all submit their estimated finish time, and we just seeded them according to that. So between having a way to seed people and then staggering the starts, and for a large event having to have two different start zones, we were able to pull off a race that exceeded the actual group size limit for an event in our state at the moment. And it felt, I have to say, it felt really good to do it. Like, no, everyone said that, they felt safe, that there wasn't, you know, that there weren't any concerns. And even some people who, you know, said they weren't planning on doing the race and didn't feel comfortable doing it because of COVID said that they were surprised at how comfortable they felt. So, we're planning on using this model for all of our winter events as well. With the only exception is using interval starts when we can for smaller group sizes. So just having people lined up and starting at distinct intervals, 15, 30 minute, whatever's appropriate. So that's how we dealt with our events. The other issues were just requiring masks to be put on at aid stations. It sounds like racers were mostly compliant with that, so that's an area to work on in the future. And then at the finish line, we just we didn't allow congregation. So it, because if you spread out the start, then the finish is pretty well spaced out too, for this kind of endurance event. But and then we just handed folks, instead of having like a meal, we handed folks a meal ticket that they could go redeem at a local restaurant. And then they submitted those tickets back to us. We paid them. So yeah, like I said, that's just kind of a summary of the main obstacle. But truly we had to change, we had to modify every single aspect of the event for it to work, during this time. So, and then communicating that to racers was also really important. Like why we're doing these things that they don't really particularly like. So
Christy, did your people in the start pen socially distance and wear masks? How did that work?
Yeah, so the start pen was a very large area. We had to move the start to our local school so that we could utilize the practice fields and have a lot of space for folks. And they did generally, they had to wear masks in the start zone. And then when they went from the start zone to step up to the start line, where our county requires 10 feet between racers in athletic events. So they had to wear the mask there. And then once they started running, they could take it off. And they were asked to carry a mask the whole time and put it back on at aid stations as well.
What about any issues on the trail? I've had this question asked to me a few times in terms of, you know, density on the trail and how do you control people out on the trail? Certainly on the hiking trails, I haven't seen any control whatsoever. Was there any concern either by your competitors or your town about what happens on the trail?
Not so much. Our trails are pretty heavily used right now, and the race, this race was over 45 miles. So it, you know, folks are spread out. And so if you have a way to seed folks, then you can prevent a lot of the congestion at the start and that bottlenecking. We also did one key part was that, you know, the start of the race, the first mile or so is on double track before it went to single track. And it was really important to keep that. And we early on, we talked about actually extending the length of time that they're on double track to allow for passing at the beginning. I did hear that there was like a little bottleneck on the mountain bike race when they were on single track, which is understandable because it's harder to pass on a mountain bike. But overall, there wasn't as great a concern about passing on the trails. We just told racers that they need to stay, you know, they should attempt 10 feet apart whenever possible. And at this point, there's such limited examples of any outdoor transmission that most people felt pretty safe. And then they all had masks as well. So if they wanted to wear a mask when passing, they could. And I believe we encouraged everyone to use, you know, to use masks when less than 10 feet was not possible.
And one final question, what was the permitting process like with the town of Crested Butte? And at least that whole process, was that laborious?
We have a county public health department that is, you know, they're the ones that control all the COVID modifications. We have many other permits for these events with the town and the U.S. Forest Service and the county, etc. But they all deferred to the county public health. And so our public health department has an events application that you can do. They did not when we were developing the event. We were one of the first events to try. We probably were the first race in our county that has happened since March. And so we kind of helped develop some of those protocols and the sort of things that folks are addressing. But now our county has an event application that's online, and we're lucky because we're a small county, so we can work directly with these officials to come up with kind of these beneficial solutions.
Right. We had one question. Did you reverse seed the fields faster first? I think you said that already.
Yes, faster first. Okay. Definitely. That, and again, that's critical because if you get that right, then it's people are spread out beautifully. And all the pictures and video that we got back, people were really well spread out. And even, you know, until they went to pass, they would keep a good 10 feet. So that was pretty nice. There was, you know, the problem is some people always get their time wrong. So we did end up with like a couple fast mountain bikers at the very end who had to pass 100 people during the race, but it's kind of their own fault at that point.
Right. Okay.
Awesome. They're not getting their info to us in time.
Right. I want to move to Justin from Nensa. And Justin, I was able to attend a couple days of this year's AppGap race. I believe that was one of the first cross-country events or races to happen since March. And so you guys were really blazing some new territory. Can you share with us the planning that went into that event and the learnings that you got from that week and how you're applying those to the future winter races?
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for having me, first of all. And the roller ski races is something we've been developing over the last years, and this AppGap Challenge event has sort of drawn the most numbers so far. So we had 174 people last year. I'd run the event for 6 or 7 years before it was a NENSA event through the Green Mountain Valley School, where I never really had any permissions. We just used the road like we used the road. The last 2 years we've had to either close one or two lanes of traffic, which is pretty problematic on a state highway, or I should say a big challenge. So this was kind of a COVID opportunity to be able to have the race. And the idea kind of came as we spawned our contingency plans for our major Eastern Cup races this winter. So the idea was to start down at plan four, which has teams coming in their own pods, assigned race times throughout the week. So we actually have that stated for the winter as well as being over a 9-day period. So you'd have, in theory, 2 weekends as well as a week to complete the event. A neat thing about the roller skis, the weather could change, and we did indeed have 2 wet days, but we had match roller skis. So every competitor who came used match skis. So that brought a pretty cool level to the playing field. Originally, like I said, we opened it up. We were thinking boy, if we had 9 days, we could have 3 pods of 10 come each day. That'd be 270 people. We never opened it up to the public. We really just invited mostly teams and clubs from within Vermont. And when we started realizing we could get up around 100 people, we felt content that that was enough to bite off on our first go. So we ran the event. They had a health screen on Wednesday, mandatory. We chased people down to the last minute till when they were getting in their van to drive to the event. We turned away one competitor who happened to be a national team skier. I won't name him because of HIPAA. And I got to move because my battery's going to die. Everybody was wearing masks, super compliant with all of our regulations. It went very, very smoothly. What we did feel is that we might be able to have even more people, which was a great way to leave the event that way. And the learnings were really around that health screen, because that's a lot of work that we wouldn't normally be doing. But we feel really good about it, and I'm trying to push our organization to keep being optimistic about, we're essentially operating our events, on Vermont guidelines, but even more strict than that, for leisure travel, because we're doing a health screen, prior and day of to the event. But that's a significant amount of work, if you're doing that. And of note, we also didn't have overlap of groups yet. That's sort of our next step for our next competition.
So to be clear, you ran kind of teams together. So that team that came in a van raced together. Nobody else was out there. They cleared the course. Maybe a half hour later, you would start the next team. So it was very, very pod oriented. And that's something different than what you'll be able to do for winter, I'm assuming. But to go back to the health screen, we're coming into fall and winter, and a lot of people have runny noses, get coughs. They're not generally a big deal. Have you looked at how that will work, how you'll be able to identify what is a serious potential illness versus what is not?
Yeah, there. I think we can look at some of our ski academies and the protocols that they're putting in place with screenings as a good waypoint, maybe, because they're, having daily experience with that. And we turned away the one individual for a sniffly nose or a runny nose because he was being really honest. He ended up doing his own time trial that day, and indeed was feeling, just fine. So yeah, that these are some of the pieces of work we still have to do. But yeah, we want to try and allow racing to happen. And I love Killington's logo of help us get open and stay open, and I think if we kind of promote that, we have this also this, it's a little more wordy cross-country promise, but it's something for all parents, coaches, and athletes to abide by. And so, yeah, I think it is putting a lot of the onus on the individual and the coaches, whether or not they feel like their athlete should be, getting in the van or the car and driving to a competition.
Right. We have a question about a COVID coordinator. I'm going to wait and ask that of Adam, because I think that's more of a U.S. ski issue. So we'll come back to that. Christy did mention that they also did a health screening at it looks like bib pickup. And so that's something that's going forward. Justin, looking at this winter, and I know we're still early, and I know in speaking to you, you've got a lot of plans on the table, but if you had to forecast what the early season races would look like, could you share any of your thoughts there?
Early season on snow races?
Yeah, those first couple of races.
Yeah, I'm doing follow-up with a lot of folks, but there's races that I think people are optimistic. They want to hold races. There might be a couple things holding them back, depending on where their venue is. But I also, we have other races that aren't on our calendar yet that will be coming out in the next couple of weeks. So I think we will. We might see limited field sizes at self-imposed venue restrictions. I think that's a reality. We'll also, of course, be under state and county guidelines. We have interesting things right now where our maps updating on Tuesday nights now instead of Friday. So two counties that we want to have major events in right now are yellow or red. That's an issue. I think that's, and Adam can speak to this too, with the regional versus national, is it's really tricky to put the decision to the athlete, the coach, or the parent about whether or not they're going to abide by quarantining guidelines, depending on where they come from. I believe most currently for Maine, if you're from Massachusetts, you can provide a negative test and you're okay. So that makes Maine attractive as a venue for folks from Massachusetts. And in New Hampshire, I don't believe has any guidelines that we would border on for gathering sizes. So Vermont's at 150 right now, which allows us to have 100, 120 competitors, perhaps.
What about your Women's Day? I know that's probably not one of the events that you...
I got you an answer. So Women's Day and also the Bill Koch festivals are potentially moving towards a regional or state model.
Okay. So you're not going, it won't be the large event.
Well, the individual ones could still be similar sizes. You know, in some ways it could be the kind of COVID opportunity. Women's Day specifically, I don't know if they ever turn people away, but I think it's bordering on how many they can accommodate.
Right.
Most years. So maybe it's even an opportunity that we could have more women engaged in that program. Bill Koch's a little tricky because the gathering size is somewhere in the 800 to 1,000 or something like that.
So you're considering regionalizing that?
Yeah. Okay. That's for your ears only here on.
Uh-huh. Okay. Won't share with anyone other than
don't my share with anybody, friends. Especially the organizers, because I see they're on the call.
Let's move that now to Adam from U.S. Ski and Snowboard. And Adam, on September 4th, you all announced several modifications to the national calendar. I know I've spoken to many people that were part of the various conversations, and I know it was certainly a challenging time and certainly hard to come up with. But could you speak a little bit to those modifications, specifically with respect to the national calendar, and then we can look more regional?
Yeah, certainly. I think it's important to note that, you know, while the announcement came out on September 4th, I think we started discussing with a working group probably in mid to late July. So we had a few weeks of discussion prior to making that announcement. That working group contained the potential event hosts for our national events. So this year we were hoping to have national championships in Houghton, Michigan, junior national championships in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and then our Super Tour finals and spring nationals were supposed to be in Craftsbury, Vermont. As well as a number of Super Tour locations, including the Berkey and a bunch of other, you know, just classic Nordic venues. you know, the issues that came up were wide ranging, and Justin touched on some of them. You know, with every state and even county to county having different ordinances, there was a potential that, you know, an athlete would be unable to attend national championships, and that's sort of an ethical quandary, where there's supposed to be an open event and any U.S. Ski and Snowboard competitor can come. And then we sort of realized, well, those head-to-head competitions are used in selection of national teams and world championship teams and world junior championship teams. And it's really just not fair, you know, if Alaska is not allowed into Michigan and those racers aren't given an opportunity to compete head-to-head. So that was a large part of the decision in choosing to cancel national events, is to reduce the impetus of athletes and skiers and parents to feel like they have to travel to a certain location on a certain date to be in certain races. And we just didn't feel that it worked for our groups. You know, national events are typically you know, national championships is usually 400 or 500 racers. Junior nationals is usually over 400 racers. So just the modifications that would have had to been made to hold those events, you know, such as limiting field sizes, were sort of contrary to the nature of the events themselves. So we decided with, you know, with the input of the working group, I think Justin and Luke and some other folks on this call might've been a part of that working group. But it just seemed like the right decision for the right time. So we, you know, opted to go to a more regional model where, you know, we're encouraging you know, regions to host events as they see fit. You know, we want New England to host events, and you know, the Western United States to host events, and Alaska to host events, and we think that by allowing more regional control, we can allow for our community to feel safer and feel better about racing, about competing.
So you're the national governing body is not overseeing regional races at this point.
Yes and no. So we have they're called NRL races or national ranking lists. So those are races that are sanctioned by US Ski and Snowboard. And in doing such, they have to abide by, you know, kind of our rules. And those rules, you know, we're sort of in the process of drafting our return to competition guidelines. And we'll try to, you know, outline how to amend those rules for the COVID situation, so that they work, so that we can host, you know, sanctioned competition this winter. At the same time, you know, I know, in addition to being the sport coordinator for US Ski and Snowboard, I'm also the divisional coordinator for Rocky Mountain Nordic. And I know we're in the process of planning a calendar that includes both the sanctioned, the NRL type races, as well as, you know, the citizens races, the town series, and trying to utilize those for athletes who, you know, may not be able to or may not feel comfortable attending the sanctioned races, and would rather race in another venue.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Let's move on to Richard from White Pine. Richard, I know you didn't run any summer events, but you are planning on running a 4-race series that takes place in 3 different counties. This is a recreational race, kind of a town race, I believe. Can you share some of your thoughts on that event? So a non, I guess, sanctioned event. What are you thinking there?
Yeah, and hello, everyone. But I think the 35th year of the race series is going to be by far the most challenging for it. Right now, we're currently working on and have almost finalized plans for all the events. But one of the large challenges we have is the 4 events are held in 3 at venues at 3 different counties that have.
Yeah. Richard seems to have paused.
Sitting process already with watershed, golf course. Sounds like my internet connection is fading. I hope you can hear me. And fire and police and all sorts of public services. And so the coordination effort there is going to be quite difficult. Yeah. So Reese, can you wave if you can hear me?
Yep, we can hear you now. Got silent for a bit.
I'm getting a warning on my computer about a shifty internet connection. So, and mass gathering permits are different in each of the 3 counties. So it's a work in progress. We're meeting with the health officials right now to determine what we can do. Typically the race will bring 300 odd skiers in every time. So it's kind of pushing the max for most places in terms of outdoor gatherings. And one of the things we've been working through is with the race crew. We have 30 people that are, you know, consistent volunteers to work on the race crew. And so right now our plan procedure is to do season only online registration for the series. So you have to register for all events at once. You'll be issued a season bib at the beginning. And if you lose it, we'll have some spares and a Sharpie around. But the skiers will be responsible. Masking rules at the start, you know, get the heck out of town at the finish. We'll have a not only a mandatory double polling segment, but also a mandatory mask segment at the start. And right now we do wave. We're going to increase the number of waves, but we're keeping our options open for interval starts only for the series, which requires more race crew, but spreads people out a little bit better. The other thing that we've got going beyond that is we're going to have a participant class for the series. So if people want to come and, you know, Garmin or Strava their own race time the day before or the day after, their results will end up in a participation class, but not in a competition class. We think it's really important to keep people engaged as, you know, in the ski community and as skiers, but give them an opportunity that if they can't or won't or don't feel comfortable participating, they still have a way to participate and they will have results. They just won't be kind of age group competition results. Then they can argue over beer later, over what the relative temperature was at the time that they did their 10K, but that'll be kind of out of our hands. But it does provide an opportunity for people to participate without being in the crowd, let's say.
So Richard, let's bring it down to that local level. What requirements will be on your racers when they show up, and how will you deliver that? Will they not be allowed inside? Will they boot up in the car? Will they have a separate training course? When will they be required to wear their masks? I mean, how are you going to handle, and Chrissy, I'm going to come to you with that same question after Richard, you know, how do you handle your group as they arrive and looking at the key things we have with masks and social distance?
Yeah, it's very good because, I mean, one of the things with our 300 participants, we'll typically have a third of them being U18, and not all of them are drivers. So we're trying to sort out how to provide start times for the younger kids and keep the adults away, and then have something to do to get the kids out of there after the finish so the adults can race, or vice versa. I'm always open to a good suggestion for timing for that, folks. But generally, everything will be outdoors. The bib pickup, at the beginning of the season is outdoors. All interactions with outside of, the timing crew will be in the office, but any public interactions will be outside. And we've got screens set up and doing a kind of a pegboard to put bibs on for bib distribution. It's going to be mask on until.
Oh, he froze again. Christy, I think I'll move to you while Richard's still frozen there. I really want to look at that. How do you handle that group of people that's coming in? How do you ensure that they are abiding by the distance, the mask, and more importantly, do they, I want to say, not so much do they care, but is that a big concern from what you saw this summer already?
So for our start zone for this event, and we'll have to do this for all the events, you kind of have to have three different points, right? It's like the time that they're allowed to show up at the venue, the time at which, at like in the general vicinity, the time where they can enter their start zone, and then the time when they can step up to the start line. And for a large event, it was really important for us to designate those different times. And so folks, I think it was groups of 50, because that way, if our group size got reduced, we could continue to operate just with more time between groups. But, you know, we had groups of 50 were given a 10-minute time, you know, zone where time slot where they could come into the start zone before they came up to the start line. And so, and then we had people every step of the way. So when they first got to the division between the two start zones, there was a volunteer who made sure that they had a mask on and showed them which way to go, which was tricky because it was still 5 o'clock in the morning and it's dark out. But in the winter during the day, that shouldn't be as big a deal. And you know, but it just took a lot more people power to get, those, to kind of get that flow going. And it, again, it sounded really complicated to us and really scary at the time, like before we did it once. But then seeing it in action, it's like, oh yeah, that's great. People are getting used to wearing masks and being socially distant and showing up at times where they're supposed to. And so, you know, people came within the 10 minutes that they were supposed to arrive, and we were able to just direct them. And it was it felt very casual, actually. And so I think that's, you know, with the first event, it's always, it's a little terrifying, but I think just having those different, just understanding those different designations of like, okay, you can't even get out of your car until this time. And then for the next 10 minutes, you can only be between here and here. And then for the next 2 minutes, you can be in here, and then we're going to start you. And having enough space to do that for any number of people is the hard part. We're considering for, you know, for some of our races, the longer distance races, this winter, having more like, instead of like the timed wave starts with 10 people every 2 minutes, we're going to experiment with our county and see if we can do like you have this 30 minute zone where these 50 people can show up and start anytime in that 30 minutes. Right. And hope that they'll just naturally spread out a little bit that way. Again, we don't have approval for something like that, but that's an idea we're working with for certain types of events that are like more like our citizen series race, right? Where we just want, you know, if they're chipped or we can start their bib at a certain time, it'll just work that way. So, but yeah, it's just a matter of like, the other thing we had to do is be like, okay, we can communicate all of what the rules are and give people, you know, we just are going to create this format that is going to keep them safe and socially distanced, and it's up to them to follow it. We cannot police every part of the course. We can't police what they're doing before or after. But we can create a framework that allows people, you know, to just socially distance.
Are we point here 6 months into this situation where the population, or at least the athletic type population, has figured out what they're comfortable with, and everyone knows mask, everyone knows hand sanitizer, everyone knows 6 to 10 feet, everyone knows outdoors is better than indoors. And looking back at events where I believe you said you can have 250 people in Colorado, will people self-police, and is that almost enough, do you think, Chrissy?
I think it's our responsibility as event organizers to create a framework that it's just easy for people to socially distance. Yeah. And then out on the course and stuff, like I'm seeing some questions about drafting and things like that. Like you just have to say that that's not allowed. And that zone is really where you don't want to be breathing that other person's air. But I think we're going to have to continue to create stringent requirements for folks. But then, you know, what is changing is that we can have that trust that people will follow them the majority of the right time.
Richard, are you're back now. We lost part of what you were saying because you froze.
Sorry about that.
That's right. If you get sketchy, you can turn off your video and maybe we can still hear you talk. But what is your crowd limit outdoors in Park City? Has that number been set?
That number is not really set. I think we're at 150 for massive distancing, but we're having discussions right now with the health department about what we may be able to do in terms of maximum people on site at one time. It's different in Wasatch County, and Salt Lake County, I believe, is still sitting at 50 people, which means it might be a very interesting weekend-long race.
So when you're saying 100, you said 150 on-site, does that mean your entire ski area can only have 150 people, or does that mean 150 people there that are participating in your event?
It's for gathering. So there isn't a limit, say, on the trail network on a Tuesday or any other random Saturday, because it's recognized that distance is what we do in Nordic. So so it's just kind of an event gathering, a formal gathering of people that's the issue.
Right. I know. In some parts of Canada, there are limits on number of people on site. I'm not really sure where that stands right now. Nick, I want to ask you a question because you at Woodstock Nordic and also Nate at Great Glen have been shuttling people this year. And we've had a lot of questions about masks and a lot of questions about getting people to events and team buses, et cetera. Can you just share with us what you thought of that shuttling procedure that you guys were going through?
Yeah, so we've been shuttling folks in our Suburban or Sprinter vans to go to different trailheads for either hiking or mountain biking or fly fishing this summer. I mean, it hasn't been an issue. Nobody has hesitated on it. None of our staff have hesitated on it. We all wear masks, obviously, in the vehicle with the guests. We have a partition up between the front of the vehicle and the rear of the vehicle where the guests ride. It's not, I wouldn't say that it really is super effective, but it's definitely, there's something there. But I don't see that that's been an issue.
Right. Justin, to go back to your upcoming winter races, could you talk us through that, just a procedure, pick, it doesn't matter what race, but a race, how do you see that working from arrival to racing and departure?
Followed by pound.
Sorry, I was on mute there. I think we're going to see the different types of races having different protocols per se, and that's really based on how we run events that NENSA does, where my job description's specifically to be organizing the Eastern Cups, and I'm indeed sort of the registrar and the go-between for just about everything on the weekend. Really well-run event organizers, I sit there and smile. It's great. And we have quite a few like that. So, but now we're going to have the regulations with Eastern Cups. I think we moved it to October 15th now. Everybody for FIS competitions or Eastern Cups in the East this year, you'll purchase a bib and you'll effectively rent a chip for the season. And those will be that will travel with you just like your USSA number, your NENSA number, or your date of birth. So we will have seating just like we typically do, but we won't have sequential bibs, which is pretty interesting. But the timers feel confident with that, so that's how we're going to move in that direction. With our popular races, there's a lot of work to keep doing because it's a lot of outreach, but the registration and the overall running of the event is actually by by the event organizer. So we will advise them on protocols, and I think they're all well aware of what we're doing. We'd hope that they would act sort of in accordance with that health pledge and also be using health screens of some sort. It really comes down to, and you'll see with US Ski and Snowboard guidance too, it really comes down to that state and local guidelines. So very much so, all of our events will be in accordance with that. We're working on a regional championships, the Eastern Regional Championships, to sort of replace the whole of junior nationals not being held this year in Minneapolis. I don't think I'm going to say where we're trying to do it in Lake Placid. We finalized the numbers and the criteria for that aren't finalized, but we're trying to create that along with U16 championships and Eastern High School championships to allow a championship experience for our junior ski racers. And perhaps by having three events and one of them being the larger regional sort of Eastern regional championships replacing junior nationals, that we can have actually more opportunities for our junior skiers this year. All of those U16s, the Eastern Regional Championships and Eastern High School Championships will all be directly under NENSA protocols.
Okay. Adam, going back to you from U.S. Ski and Snowboard, how do you see, so we've heard from NENSA, is what Justin's saying being replicated in the other regions or something similar?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the process of sanctioning a race with U.S. Ski and Snowboard, there's a lot of rules, as many of you know, in terms of like how races are seeded and how the races have to go off and what the results have to look like. So we're in the process of coming up with sort of recommendations of how you can, you know, abide by those rules, which are in place to make sure that the race is fair. While still, you know, abiding by socially or physically distance, you know, both at the start and on the course. So like, you know, one of the thoughts is, you know, should we just reverse seed every race where the person with the lowest points or the person who is in theory the fastest, you know, should we reverse seed and have them go out first to minimize congestion on course? In some respects, congestion on course doesn't seem to be the risk scenario. You know, there's not a ton of risk of that fleeting, you know, passing of another athlete. It's really the start and the finish and those kinds of things. So we're coming up with a list of recommendations for the venues, you know, about, you know, don't allow congregating inside, which is a tough one. If it's 4 degrees and howling wind, you know, people are going to have to utilize their personal vehicles largely for shelter on race days, which is certainly not ideal, but I think it's something that we may have to utilize in order to host racing this year. But a lot of things, you know, Justin talked about, and a lot of things that Christy talked about with respect to how to hold the race and the medical checks, you know, the season long bib registration, that sort of thing. You know, nationally, I think we're encouraging regions to look into. It's not something that we, you know, as a national governing body, you know, can step in and say, you know, everyone's going to use the same bib for the year because we don't have bibs, you know. But New England has their own bibs, and we're hoping every region can kind of take a play out of their book and follow suit.
So it sounds like most of our the regions are going to have the final say, and the state and local health departments are going to have the final say. It sounds like most people have outdoor gatherings ranging from 100 to 250, so a large enough number. And it sounds like the plan could simply be some form of registration on site if need be. Obviously, NENSA has that dialed, I think, a little better. But a distance outdoor registration, mask required, limited indoor access, use your car for your personal shelter. Perhaps your team would bring a tent and that would work, but strictly team only, or those in that pod. masks at the start, masks after the finish. I guess it's optional. You can wear a mask as you race, but that's up to you. Has anyone heard of racers opting out of the season at this point or concerned enough to possibly not race? I'll throw that back to Adam or Justin.
Let me add one other interesting tidbit is that a lot of teams aren't going to be allowed to transport athletes this year. So, you know, teams that would typically roll up in a 15 passenger van with one coach driving and, you know, 10 kids in there. A lot of at least the teams in Colorado will not be able to do that. So we will be relying a lot more on, you know, parent travel. That'll certainly make things interesting.
Is that a regional rule?
I think it largely comes down to the club, you know, what the club rules state. Okay. And if you look at, you know, the state, the local guidelines sort of trump all. If, you know, if the local county says you can only have 100 people, you can only have 100 people. You know, US Ski and Snowboard can't step in and say, no, you can have 200. But, you know, we have a series of layers of, you know, first abide by your city, state, county, local guidelines. Then there are, you know, US Ski and Snowboard wide guidelines. Then there are US Ski and Snowboard cross country specific guidelines. So there's a number of layers of, you know, what should we do? But it all comes down to state and local. They are the ultimate, you know, yay or nay sayers. But within there are a lot of clubs, and I know, you know, a number of counties, you know, in Vermont, for example, where they are sort of proud that their guidelines are more strict than they need to be. And you know, that's probably a good thing for the health of the community. But it also, you know, from the club standpoint, it makes traveling to races with athletes a real challenge this year.
We'll have a really good idea starting on October 15th when we open up bib and chip sales, essentially, of at least our Eastern Cup fields. And we're also going to have built into that at least a survey of what events they feel like they might attend this year. So we'll have a better idea of that. And another idea of getting all of that information earlier, you won't be guaranteed entrance into an event, say a FIS event that has a limited number of capacity. But you'll need to have that in order to do the race. So we should have a pretty good idea. And, you know, we had 567 unique competitors last year in those events, including the colleges. And the colleges are a really unique piece and something we're working hard to try and support, because there's still a lot in the air, and the college students are bound to pretty strict regulations, right? Very strict, I would say, right now, either within counties or within some tens of miles of their college campus. And that has nothing to do with athletics. That has to do with their broader college policy. So it's definitely interesting. I'm hopeful that we have a number between 400 and 500 that are ready to go in those Eastern Cup races. I think it won't hurt us that they're a little smaller for compliance and running really safe events. But obviously we don't want them to get smaller. But I think that's a reality.
Right. Adam, are there any, I know this really isn't your area, but any learnings from Europe, like the FIS, are there any protocols, and I'm talking more specifically like race day or training days when people are actually out on a controlled course, have they come up with any of protocols just for that specific piece?
Not that I've heard. I think FIS largely stays out of the, of that aspect and leaves that up to the nations. You know, the one thing FIS does do is they hold us to standards. So we've asked for FIS to, kind of soften some of their homologation standards and soften some of their timing standards, and they are unwilling to do so. So we're bound to those rules. if we want our races to be FIS sanctioned. At the national level, we have a little more flexibility to do so. But historically, we've, you know, just, you know, if this is the FIS rule, we're just going to follow it unless we really need to change it. So some of those discussions are ongoing currently. But, you know, short answer is no, FIS hasn't really provided much that I've, or anything that I've seen, and maybe I've missed it, with respect to the sort of the actual running of an event.
Right, right. It seems like this conversation, it needs to be ongoing, because we're now mid-September. Back to school is happening. Colleges are back on campus, and I know many of those college sports, be it skiing or other, are still trying to work it out and have not figured it out. I know Mike Hussey this morning was saying that the NCAA has said that they are planning on running a national championship for skiing, but they don't know what that means. I have a hockey player in my family, and likewise, they said a national championship is on the schedule, but they don't have a start date for when they're going to be playing games or when they're even going to be practicing yet. So a lot still to be considered. I do want to point out one thing that Linda from Calgary mentioned, you know, regarding the vehicle idling, and certainly one of the issues that that COVID has brought. I know we've worked so hard to be environmentally conscious in so many ways. Now you can't bring a reusable coffee cup to wherever you go. And she was saying to avoid idling, bring sleeping bags and enough clothing to stay warm. And I think that's a great point, because we do need to maintain our environmental aspect. We're pretty much out of time, so I'd like to thank our panel, Christy from Crested Butte, Justin from NENSA, Adam from US Ski, and Richard from White Pine. This was a great discussion. Much like everything, there is no one size fits all answer for everyone. Everyone runs a different type of event under different circumstances. Certainly those of us in Vermont, we have very stringent rules right now, and you really are not invited to come here from many areas. So that's problematic. And I know things will change everywhere. I would like to revisit this in a couple of weeks, or maybe a month and a half or so, when we get a little closer and people have really identified what their actual plan is going to be. But thank you to our panelists. Thank you for everyone who joined the call. Appreciate it. The audio of this call, as well as some notes, will be available on Monday on the KISSA website, same place that they all are. So feel free to check that out or pass that on to the rest of your staff. And thank you again. I look forward to seeing you all in person somewhere soon. Take care.